the Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, CTO of Sigital and author of Software Security. This podcast series is co-sponsored by Sigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine. For more, see www.computer.org/security and www.sigital.com/silverbullet. This is the 22nd in a series of interviews with security gurus, and I'm happy to have with me today Ed Amoroso. Hi, Ed.
Hey, Gary. How you doing?
I'm doing good. Ed Amoroso is the CISO of AT&T, a position he's held for almost a decade. His PhD in computer science is from Stevens Institute of Technology. Ed started working at Bell Labs right out of school and rose through the ranks at the labs and then moved into the business side. His responsibilities now include security strategy, incidents response and monitoring, and lots of customer interaction. Ed's written a number of books in security, including books for executives such as Cybersecurity and more technical tomes, including The Fundamentals of Computer Security Technology and Intrusion Detection. Ed and his wife, Lee, have a New Jersey houseful with two daughters and a son. So I wanted to start things off asking you about this. You've known Peter Neumann for a long time. Peter was silver bullet victim in episode 14, I guess since you were 3 years old. And I wondered how or whether Peter's thinking in security influenced your career and your thinking and all that jazz.
Well, it certainly did. You know, of all my parents' friends, my dad is also a computer scientist. Peter is always by far the most interesting. He would come and read our retinal patterns and tell us all kinds of real kind of interesting stories. So I guess when I was a little kid, I associated interesting with computer security, and here we are.
Right? There you go. It could have been the tuba, I suppose. So it was darn close.
That's right.
So one of the technical issues that Peter has been particularly vocal about, and I think rightly so, is the importance of architecture when it comes to building security in. You know, software security in practice today seems to be a little bit more about bugs than about flaws. That is about, you know, implementation problems instead of architectural problems. Do you think that too much attention is being placed on things like cross-site scripting bugs to the detriment of architectural progress? And you know, how does that impact your work at AT&T?
Well, it's like the difference between wellness and good health and a guy bleeding out on the street, right? So, I mean, when there are problems and there are bugs in software that you rely on and depend on, then you have no choice, right? You have to be aware of these flaws, and you have to come up with fixes. So one dimension certainly is the whole triage. And you and your gang, you guys are really good at that. And, you know, we depend on software security experts to help keep us aware. And it's tough because that can very easily devolve into like a trivial pursuit game, you know,
where you're
keeping track of all this crazy arcane stuff.
Yeah, it's the bug parade approach is what I like.
Right. I mean, so it'd be crazy to say you can't, you know, you want to stop that. You absolutely have to continue doing that. But, you know, my primary issue from an architecture and engineering system design perspective has always been that security should not be an overlay. Mm-hmm. I mean, when you try and overlay anything, or try and retrofit something, it's never a clean fit. I mean, I like to draw an analogy to the reliability overlays that you saw in telecom in the 1980s, where we'd make a big deal of the fact that we could overlay these fast rerouting algorithms onto an existing telecom network. Mm-hmm. And you'd see these charts where people would say, oh, look, instead of making your call directly from New York to Boston, we can avoid congestion and route you from New York to, you know, Chicago to Boston. And everybody would go, ooh, and, you know, it looked like such an interesting approach. Well, now we would laugh at that. That's all embedded into the underlying infrastructure. You would never overlay reliability onto a network now. It has to be an intrinsic sort of component. Similarly, in the 90s, we did that with quality.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we hired consultants to come in and tell us how to add quality, and we would sing quality songs and, you know, do TQM and, you know, try to do all these things that would take the systems that we were building and take the business processes that we were enforcing and designing and then overlay some sort of a quality onto it, and we've since realized how silly that is, that you can't do quality separately. You have to do it as an embedded component. Well, we live in a decade right now where network engineers and system engineers and computer scientists and security people think absolutely nothing of designing a system, writing a piece of software, designing a network, building an infrastructure as step A. And then step B is, okay, now let's do security and do it as like this add-on or overlay. And that never works. Never works, particularly in software, right? I mean, I don't even know how you do that
in a
program without, starting with a basic understanding of what you're trying to do.
Well, you sort of have to be confused about it. If you think, hey, security must be that cryptography stuff, or maybe it's that authentication stuff, or maybe it's that password system. So you think of security as a thing instead of as a property, then maybe that explains the confusion. So
there's no question about it.
And one pithy way of putting that is, software security is not really security software. Do you think that message has, caught on at all, or are people still fundamentally confused about that out there?
It's hard to say. You see evidence occasionally. Sometimes you'll see a well-crafted piece of code and just sit back and admire. But then you still see, even from very large corporations, you see these grand initiatives where the word security is in there somewhere, and it's this add-on, like we've got this initiative to go kind of make things secure. I guess if, to get from point A to point B, if that's necessary, then fine. But ultimately, for the same reason that you wouldn't say we need to do XYZ to make our software more dependable, you just embed it in. I don't see the difference for security. I've always had a hard time differentiating software correctness from software security.
Yeah,
I know
that's
something you and I have had some private discussions around in the past. That I guess you really could kind of come up with different views, but to me, the way software is exploited is that somebody goofs, and sometimes they're lucky and the goof is exploitable in a way that's not all that important. Other times they'll goof in a way where the exploitation is significant. It can allow people to take control of an operating system or make an application go berserk or something.
Mm-hmm.
So, and in all cases, it just strikes me that the software is too complicated.
Right. It had low quality, and that
simplifying
was
simplifying is the most important thing.
Yeah, I actually agree with you on that. I think maybe the difference between software quality and software security is while you're doing software quality types of things, best practices like code review and whatnot, if you think about who your potential attacker is, it might change the way you're thinking about quality a little bit. So if say, you're up against Russian organized crime versus just some stupid bug, then hopefully you're going to up your level of quality a little bit.
Yeah, I guess that's true. I remember being up on my big high horse, standing on my soapbox making a big deal about software correctness. I mean, when I was sort of growing up as a graduate student, I was a disciple of Edgar Dijkstra and just thought that everything he ever said was gospel. And, I still continue to maintain that much of what he says is so good. But
can you fit 6 million lines on a napkin, though? I mean, come on.
Somebody pointed out to me that in countries, particularly in Western Europe, where Dijkstra was taken very seriously, there's almost certainly a weaker software industry than in, say, the U.S., where we're very happy to throw code out in the wind and hope that it works.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there really is, to your point, there's this context sensitivity and knowing your audience, knowing what you're building to, and it's one thing to be building something that will be a, some SCADA controller, say in a power plant or something, and it's another to be building a little script that you're using to, share a printer in an office. Those
Right.
are two fundamentally different pieces of code. They require different attentiveness, and the vulnerability associated with each is very different.
Yeah, I remember having a talk, listening to Brian Kernighan talk about the kinds of code quality and beauty you need in order to have a telephone switch. And he showed us some of the software that you guys actually maintain. And it was very, very interesting to hear him talk about that stuff. So during your talks, you often discuss the idea of moving security into the cloud, noting that it's kind of silly for every individual customer to invest a huge amount of energy at the endpoint, doing things like putting firewall filters in IDS systems.
Yeah, that's right.
So can you tell us a little bit more about that idea and what the market reaction has been to that?
pretty varying. Well, the first thing is a lot of us, you know, you, me, and others, for many years in our careers, we're tending to firewalls. I mean, tending to intrusion detection systems. And when I mean tending to, I mean managing them and stuffing rules into them and having almost this emotional relationship with these pieces of equipment in our lab. We've all been there, right? So, you know, there was a time when operating a firewall, tending to a firewall, was a relatively skilled art, something that required that you understand how protocols work, something that required the ability to write scripts on the fly, something that required an ability to act in real time. Whoa, we got a problem here. Quickly, need to hack something together to go in and stop it. I mean, that's not something that you just go to a vendor and buy. It's not something that you subscribe to. Mm-hmm. It's that you had, you know, for years, certainly through the late 80s, early 90s, when the basic principles of perimeter management were being put together, you know, culminating in World Wide Web. You know, everything busted open at that point, right? Yeah. Everybody was connected to everything.
Cram it all through port 80 and call it soap.
Yeah, right. So there was a time when tending to a perimeter was an art that required a great deal of attention, time and attention. And generally, you would have one or two gateways. You know, I remember in AT&T, we had a research gateway going out to the Internet, and I'm making my fingers like little quotes here when I say the Internet, because right. You remember when you'd say the Internet, it was like it meant that thing, you know, that was kind of growing. You know, we had a research gateway or a couple of gateways, it makes sense to have some, perimeter protection. But now, what business, at least what sizable business, doesn't have thousands of connections out to untrusted networks, and what even smaller, modest-sized business doesn't have dozens or hundreds of connections? And at home, how many connections do you have out? You know, I have my choice of Wi-Fi networks in my own home. So it struck us as pretty obvious a number of years ago that, first of all, this didn't make a lot of sense to have all this distribution of responsibility. And second, it's not even a terribly pleasant task for most people. I mean, go to your next cocktail party and ask, you know, people for a show of hands of who enjoys administering their PCs. And you find that, you know, how that works,
question.
Gary. I'm sure people corner you all the time. Oh, Gary, you're a software guy. Would you come fix my PC? You know, you could probably fix everybody at the party would have a broken PC. So it's not a pleasant task, right?
So
by pushing more and more of the protection upstream, we follow a couple basic principles. Number one is that amortization has always been a good concept in computer security. Like in the old mainframe days, it wasn't much fun to stand in that line to go get your printout. You went up to that glass window and you banged on it, and somebody went up to a big mainframe printer and handed you your printout. That wasn't good. But you were able to put your best system administrators on that mainframe, and there wasn't, you know, you knew that it was at least getting somewhat expert treatment, and it
they
was
were the wizards
right?
in the glass cage.
So that's one principle that's sort of, in my mind, reasonable amortization. Mm-hmm. Second basic principle is that you'd like to stop attacks closer to where they originate, right? You don't want to, outside my office in Florham Park, I have this little cartoon tape to my door, and it shows these two people in bed, and there's a guy like tapping the guy, waking him up, and he says, "Hey, can I interest you in security systems?" And it's like we allow that kind of with attacks. We let them come across an infrastructure, through a gateway, onto a LAN, down the LAN, on through load balancing system, through some routers, right up to our system, and boom, we stop it, you know, just one file system away from the thing we're trying to protect.
Yep.
It's like tell me who allows inbound telnet, and then explain to me why, as a carrier, we're allowing inbound telnet if that's something you don't allow. Why don't you just tell the carrier, here's my policy.
Right.
And then suddenly the carrier's network becomes this big policy-aware blob, and it will forward or not forward based on policies that you describe and that you define and that you control in real time. So I've heard that sometimes referred to as outsourcing, and I roll my eyes and say, that isn't outsourcing. It's just a different way of looking at networking. It's a different way of, in some sense, partnering with the telecom provider. Now, Gary, you asked, you know, how is this message being met? It gets met with varying degrees of acceptance. I mean, on the one hand,
the firewall vendors probably don't like
it. Yeah, well, I mean, look, you and I are both computer scientists. I mean, I'm, in addition to working at AT&T, I still teach at Stevens and still consider myself in some sense an academic. When I come at it from a computing perspective, I think most people recognize that there's some degree of validity in the just the architectural claims. The problem is that, you know, you get these marketing issues embedded kind of in the message as well. And sometimes people will say, well, you know, you're just saying that because you work for a carrier and, you know, you're trying to make a whole bunch of money here. And, you know, it's kind of awkward because the message is not rooted in marketing. The message is rooted in infrastructure protection.
Absolutely. Yep.
But, you know, there's no question that I do work for a carrier. I am a representative of the, you know, the telecom industry. And yes, you know, make no bones about it, if more of this stuff shifts into the network, then the telecom providers will, you know, there'll be more work for them, more responsibility, and, you know, potentially more revenue. So, you know, you get all sorts of different responses, but always try and frame the argument in the context of infrastructure protection.
Yeah, well, you know, now that we have so many home PCs on the edge, I think you've said hilariously that many people have no clue that their computer is leading a secret life of crime. I guess that's really the only hope we have in trying to battle something like malware.
Well, what, I don't know. Some people think that a lighter client would make sense. I mean, I know you've in your book on gaming, you point to the fact that, you know, the gaming providers are starting to rely on the end user to provide and enhance the computing environment. That's sort of an argument away from a lighter client. But I certainly would like to see, you know, for people who, take my mother as an example, she needs to get on the internet, she needs to get her email, occasionally needs to open an Office application. That's pretty much it. So what the heck is she doing with a big giant Windows machine with, you know, 99.9% of the software running on it, she not only has no use for, she just doesn't even know what it is. So why is that sitting there? You know, it's sitting there, you know, in some sense for the convenience of the computing industry, where it's just easier to sell everybody a PC than, you know, for her to have something that would be much more appropriate, namely, you know, a lighter client with less software running on it, less opportunity for attack. And for my mother, it would be easier to administer. Mm-hmm. So there's both the, you know, network providers can potentially come along and help, but there's also, it strikes me, a very sane argument for there being considerably less software running on the desktop. And you know what's cool, Gary? My kids, you know, they're 14, 12, and 7. I think if you did a pie chart or a histogram of the origin of the software that they use in a daily basis, the vast majority of it does not live on their computer.
Absolutely, yep.
You know, isn't that amazing?
You know,
like,
what's funny
so
is
different
it's
from
kind
10
of
10 years ago.
Yeah, and it's kind of like Peter's vision of the thin client. And
yeah, it's this virtualized
it's
kind
back.
Of society.
VT100's for everybody.
Yeah.
so one, VT100. One huge advantage that you have by being a provider in the middle of the cloud is the ability to spot huge trends. And some of the trend data pictures that you show in your talks are truly amazing.
Yeah.
Can you tell us about one of the most effective metrics that you use consistently that render those sorts of
pictures? Volumetrics. Mm-hmm. Just counting.
So did, you know, Led Zeppelin just did their first concert in 19 years, I guess, in London on December 10th.
Yeah.
And I hear that 20 million people registered for tickets. Did you guys see that?
Those old hippies, right?
Yeah, but did you see it on the net? I mean,
yeah, we see it. Absolutely. See, I mean, Look, for each of the different types of services that any provider offers, you've got to have the ability in a network operations center to correlate external events with what you see on the network. Like Super Bowl Sunday, boom, you see a big blip downward. You know, American Idol, you see a big blip upward in traditional sort of TDM and mobile telephony. And, you know, certainly internet as well. You know, some kooky event on the internet where everybody wants to go in and watch, I don't know, some fashion show or something that everybody's all excited about. Boom, you watch the, you watch the volumetrics on the, across the IP infrastructure go crazy. The trick is trying to figure out how to correlate things that you see with potential indicators of future attack, because you and I both know doesn't do you much good to notice that the infrastructure or some enterprise or your network's under attack. You already know it. Like, a lot of times people say, oh, I got this great tool. It'll tell you when your LAN is down. And I go, when my LAN's down, I know it.
I know. I keep clicking the mouse. Nothing happens.
Down. I can't get on. So, you know, that it doesn't make sense to sort of observe something that's happened or is happening. You want to somehow come up with indicators that some event is about to occur, is pending, or is getting started. That's the real R&D activity around this. And, it, you know, it's complicated. You know, that's, you start with the basic stuff you learned when you were reading Doug Comer's book on TCP/IP. You look at that TCP/IP full association. You look at the IP addresses of where it's coming from and where it's going to, everything. And that's tricky because a botnet, you know, particularly a botnet running, you know, fast flux where, you know, servers in some sense are hidden by this round robin approach to putting PCs in front of a server. God, you look at the sources and it's almost worthless.
Right.
Destination is always very interesting.
Right, right.
Because you know where an attack is being aimed. So as a carrier, we tend to, instead of trying to go out and police all the potential sources, what you end up doing is trying to protect customers. Now, if you decide that you want to go, and let's say AT&T is a purveyor of DSL, I forget how many we're up to, but it's 13, 15, some million DSL customers. If we decided, hey, we're going to go police all those DSL customers inbound, outbound, you know, it's a little tough because you break services. You decide that you want to, for example, cut off all UDP traffic inbound, outbound, you're going to break stuff. I mean, as it is, we, you know, it just got so bad with spam and with relays of, you know, outbound port 25 TCP, we do filter by default. And does that cause some problems for customers? Well, you know, if somebody's trying to run a, you know, a little mail server on an SMTP server on their through their home, then they've got to call us up, and we've got to go designate an exception for them. But it's a tricky sort of thing, and that's the essence of most of the research and development going on in my own team, you know, the security R&D that we're doing, because our dream scenario is to be able to write signatures and create these anomaly patterns that we can look for in the network, and when we see them, take action to sort of keep things running. I
mean, yeah, because you guys you're in a great position really to monitor the cloud. But
that's what we're doing.
There's a danger that comes with that power to look and filter. And so, and that is the one you well know, you know, privacy and customer privacy and how you trade that off against security. What do you think?
It's always been there. I mean, if you go back to the 70s and 80s, you had a situation where toll fraud was becoming pretty rampant.
Right.
You know, people finding ways to, you know, use telephony service without paying. And a typical sort of case would be, let's say you had a little business with an 800 number and you had all your employees call the 800 number. They get dial tone, they dial out, you get one bill. This is sort of 70s, 80s technology. You wouldn't do it that way now. But in those days, you did it that way. And then some nasty kid finds out about it, you know, tells all his friends, and suddenly you have 80 bazillion phone calls to Elbonia overnight. Well, the way that was solved is that the phone companies and credit card companies, anybody else doing that type of transactional analysis, we'll watch and we'll profile your behavior. And if you haven't called Albonia in the last 6 months or a year, and then suddenly you call Albonia, boom, you get popped into a database, you know, where we're going to be watching you. And now, wow, you called Albonia again. You called Albonia again. Pass some threshold, a ticket is opened. An operator then calls you up and says, oh, Mr. McGraw, do you mean to be calling Albonia all night? And you go, no, I don't. And you put your clothes on, run in, go to your PBX or something. You change the passwords. And then you call up Sprint or Verizon or AT&T, whoever you got, and you thank them. And I would say that in 20 years we never had anybody say, wait a minute, you mean you're watching? We're calling Albonia?
You know? Well, you said something that was pretty funny the other day about how kids get surprised that each telephone call is actually on the
bill.
Isn't
that funny? Like, the kids, they're right.
What?
Like, what's the difference between telephony and HTTP? To them, it's all the same. It's texting. It's IM. It's MySpace, it's Facebook, it's talking on the phone, they're all the same.
Right.
So their question is, why would we keep track of and bill you for phone services and not sort of keep track of and bill you for web services? And the answer is, they grew up in different places.
Right.
And in different technologies. But ultimately, I don't think there's anybody in the industry who wouldn't say that at some point, that blending, that bleeding of services will become very natural. You know, you see it now with VoIP. You know, so the privacy thing is something we're well aware of. And look, we, as a service provider, the word service means that we're there to serve, and we're there to serve society and our customers. And, you know, it's by no means anybody's intention in the telecom industry to be crosswise with your customers. You do that, you're going to be out of business real quickly. So what we're always trying to do is balance the needs of protecting our infrastructure, doing R&D, doing the right thing, following services like toll fraud that were very successful. And then if there are things that are uncomfortable, like, for example, me sitting and monitoring your DSL connection looking for inbound, outbound attack, you probably would say, I prefer you don't do that, and we don't. So, you know, we create these bounds and constraints based on a model of what we think is the right thing for customers. And it isn't easy because, like I said, the toll fraud has been a very successful run, but you and I both know that you can't apply the same model, you know, that worked for telephony to internet service.
Right.
It doesn't work, and you'd be run out of town if you tried it.
So I want to switch gears for the last question. You are pretty deeply involved with the Hugh Thompson Show.
Yeah.
On which I've been a guest myself, and
that's right.
And the question is, what do you hope to accomplish with that show?
Yeah, let me tell you a little bit about that. We started streaming on ATT.com, started streaming little video short clips about security events as they were unfolding.
Uh-huh.
You know, I mentioned a little while ago that we were trying to find a way to identify patterns of attack as they're happening. Well, we've had some success, like the that old slammer worm from 2003, and Notchy and Blaster, and, you know, all these kooky worms that were bouncing around, and now DDoS attacks from botnets. We see them. We see them building up speed. And rather than stand on the hill with a, you know, megaphone and scream out to everybody, can't do that, but we realized that we could send alerts and page people and make these little videos. So I built a little studio, and we were literally going and powdering the noses of our analysts off the knock floor and putting them
in front of
a camera.
I knew you came from somewhere. I didn't know.
Yeah. So we're putting up in front of a camera, and next thing I know, I've got this infrastructure for doing that. And I said, why don't we start doing some news? So we started doing a daily news show, and you can get it at att.com/techchannel. The news, we hired some anchors, and then we started doing some other shows. Now, I've been friends with Hugh Thompson for a while. He's written some awesome books on computer security and software security. And when I first met him, I don't know what it was, but I looked at him and I said, that guy looks like he would be a good talk show host.
It's because he said dude all the time.
Yeah, right. I called him and said, hey, you want to try it? He said, sure. And we created the first talk show for computer scientists and for computer security people. We've had Richard Stallman, we've had you, we've had, you know, you name it, just about every name computer security has been there talking about things in a mature way. Like the idea has always been, let's not talk like we're talking to a mass crowd, because the beauty of the World Wide Web is that we can reach an audience that has half a clue about computer security. Now, the funny thing is, when we started doing it, we thought that it would just be nerds and geeks who like it. But, you know, we're at the point now where that program is starting to really get very popular, and popular in places where we wouldn't have expected, like with a lot of young people who don't have any prior background or perhaps even interest in computer security, but they see a quirkiness in the show and in the band and in the guests and in the little things that I've had people come up to me and say, it's the new Joe Franklin show for the, and I said, all right, I like that. I love Joe Franklin. Yeah. So we're going to keep doing them. We got a whole bunch more we're doing in 2008. I think we probably have done anywhere between 60 and 80 episodes, and we're, you know, full throttle. We love the show. In fact, at the RSA show in the spring of 2008, it'll be the second keynote. We're actually bringing the whole set, the band, the whole thing, and doing a live Hugh Thompson show for the RSA crowd.
Sounds like fun.
Yeah, it'll be great.
Cool. Hey, well, thanks for your time today. Appreciate it.
You bet, Gary. Always nice to talk to you.
This has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. The January-February 2008 issue of IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine features a technology forecast roundtable with Whit Diffie, Bob Blakely, and Steve Bellavin, as well as an article addressing potential hazards in the Protect America Act. Silver Bullet is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine, where Silver Bullet excerpts are published in every issue. Subscribe today at www.computer.org/security/BSI-sub. Show links, notes, and an online discussion can be found on the Silver Bullet webpage at www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is Gary McGraw.